My guest is the guitarist so many rock musicians measure themselves against, one of the first guitar heroes, Eric Clapton. In the early 60s, he played an important part in the British blues scene as a member of the Yardbirds and John Mayall's Bluesbreakers. But with Cream, Blind Faith, and Derek and the Dominoes, he became a rock superstar. For about the last 15 years, he's recorded under his own name. Clapton has a new album called Journeyman, which shows off his blues-inspired playing and singing. Last year, a 4-CD retrospective of Clapton's music was released called Crossroads. I asked Eric Clapton his response to having his whole career represented in a box set.
I found it all very, very encouraging because I realized after it had become quite successful that people were willing to accept what I'd done in my more kind of rougher, beaten-up states as much as they were the sort of polished things, which gave me a lot of encouragement to make the record that I've just made.
Mm-hmm. Now, you started out known as a blues guitar virtuoso, but you later turned more to songs and you focused at least as much on singing as on playing. Where do you think of yourself as being now in proportion between playing and singing?
I think I'm really a band leader more than anything now. I get my biggest kick from playing with top-caliber musicians and really putting a band sound together. Because I don't really think of my guitar playing or my voice as being strong enough, although a lot of people think my guitar playing could be, but I don't think either one of those things is strong enough to just kind of go on its own. You know, I think that really I'm actually a lot happier to think about making a team effort, and I like to think of it that way. So I actually prefer to think of the whole thing as being a group sound, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me play the track that's the single from your new record. The record's Journeyman, and the single is called Pretending. Do you want to say anything about this before we hear it?
Yeah, I'd like to say that it was written by a great friend of mine called Jerry Williams, I really would like to see him become exposed one day and have his own album. But I love the song, and I've had it around for several years, and I've always wanted to do it.
Let's give it a listen. This is Pretending from Eric Clapton's new album, Journeyman. An excerpt of Pretending from Eric Clapton's new album, Journeyman. You said that at some point in your career that you got bored with virtuoso musicianship. What was the turning point for you?
Well, I think that might have been a very glib way for me to say that I couldn't get it any better. I actually had reached the end of my capabilities, I think. And a lot of people were taking it further on, so I suppose I had to develop some kind of attitude about it, and it was probably better off for my face to say that I was getting bored, you know.
So after you felt you couldn't take it any further, you wanted to turn to something else?
No, I just realized that technically my potential was probably had come to its end, you know. I'm not that nimble, really. I don't think I can compete on the sort of the fast, furious guitar sort of championships. So I tended to go the other way.
By going the other way, you mean singing more?
Yeah, singing more or just kind of refining my technique to somewhere where I could simplify it and get more out of it, with doing less, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think a lot of, you know, a lot of today's newer guitar heroes took some of their inspiration from you. And I'm wondering if what you think when you see and hear some of the excesses of of playing and of theatrics now.
Sometimes extreme jealousy, I think. I don't know. Seriously, I think they take it too far. I think it's become a means to an end. You know, it's just like flashy for its own sake a lot of the time, and I think that becomes the focal point of why they do it, and they forget about tone or finesse and some of the more the refinements of it. You know, because I think the easiest way to tell one guitar player from another is when they're playing simply. You know, you can tell the touch, you know.
It took you a while before you started singing regularly on your records. And I was wondering, when you decided to start to sing more, if it was difficult to find your voice.
No, I've always sung, you know. Ever since I was a kid, I sing along with records, singing in the, you know, just when I'm kind of moving around, I'm singing in my head and I'm singing out loud too. But it wasn't until I heard myself on tape that I realized how difficult it was to be a proficient singer. That is to say, just basically sing in tune. And then I started to meet people. In fact, only recently I've met some of the members in my band, for instance, have got perfect pitch, and they were born with that. And I realised that there are people who have the gift and others who don't. I don't consider myself to have the gift, and so I have to work extra hard at it, you see. That's the problem with singing for me, is that it's really an uphill climb all the time.
Mm-hmm. Your first inspiration musically was Black Blues by African-American performers. How were you first exposed to it?
When I was a little boy of about 9 years old, I think I heard a couple of records on the radio just being slotted in different variety programs that were by blues musicians from America. One was quite popular, actually, in England. It was called Whooping and Hollering by Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee. And it was an instrumental thing with harmonica and guitar. And country blues, really, fast country blues. And then I heard also Big Bill Brunzi, who was quite popular in Europe during the 50s and early 60s, and a fantastic guitar player and a great folk artist, you know. And I was immensely attracted to the sound. I was immensely attracted to the spirit of the music. And I decided to kind of examine it, investigate. And so I became a blues collector, buying export blues records at export shops. And I got finally into people like Muddy Waters and Robert Johnson and all of the country blues players. And that's really where I got all my influences from to begin with.
Did you teach yourself guitar?
Yes, there was no one else interested in the kind of thing I was interested in. It was a very strange, unique phenomena that I was probably one of about four or five people in England, I guess, that at the time that were interested in that particular kind of music. So it was quite lonely, but I was dedicated to it. I loved that music, and I wanted to play it.
What were some of the greatest frustrations of being self-taught?
Not really knowing that, for instance, when you pick up a six-string guitar, and I didn't know how to tune it, you know. I mean, just basically didn't know how to tune it. And I refused, you know, I mean, a quite arrogant way to buy the books, you know, buy even those Teach Yourself How to Play Basic Guitar books. So I had to learn how to tune the guitar on my own.
And those books had awful songs.
Well, yeah, that's what, you know, Old Black Joe was the kind of...
Exactly, yeah.
Obligatory kind of song. I couldn't stand that stuff, and I refused to do it any other way but my own way. And then the next step was, once, if you considered you had got it in tune, was that if you put your fingers on different frets and then tried to make a chord, I was under the impression I was inventing all this stuff, you see, and in actual fact, it was all being done before, but it was a great... I prefer to think of it, of doing it that way, because I felt like I was discovering it all.
Eric Clapton is my guest, and he has a new record called Journeyman. You were learning the blues as a white Englishman, and you were very removed from the lives of the bluesmen whose music you were emulating. Was there an element of romance in your mind to what the blues musician's life was? And did you know anybody who was remotely like the musicians whose work you were listening to and trying to play?
I didn't know anybody at all that I could identify with in that way. But to the first part of your question was that, yes, it was incredibly romantic. I could identify in some aspects in that I came from a very poor country background. And so, I was kind of maybe like a white counterpoint of in the English South, you know, except there wasn't a racial situation at all. But we were very poor, and it was like... You know, it was. I imagine it'd be quite similar to somewhere in Mississippi. I don't. Maybe not. But I tend to identify with it in that way. And I kind of dreamt of myself being this this lonesome blues singer. You know, at a very early age.
Do you remember the first time you actually performed with a black blues musician?
I think it would have been Sonny Boy Williamson. Yeah, and I was already in a professional band called the Yardbirds. I was around 18 years old, and Sonny Boy had just done a tour with the Country Blues Festival through Europe, and he decided that he would like to stay in England and make some money, because it was possible then for blues performers like himself to go through Europe and make an incredible amount of money, which is more than they could dream of making in America. And the Yardbirds were somehow linked up with him through the management people to do a tour of England. And I met him and was incredibly scared of him. He was a very, very, a frightening man. I mean, a very nice man, but he had an attitude that he could adopt at any point that was really quite terrifying. Apart from that, musically, he was so inspiring that it was the first taste I had of the real thing, you know.
And what was your reaction to it?
My reaction was very mixed. First of all, I think you get into this... I was very possessive about the blues, and I thought that being that I was one of the only people playing it in England, I tended to think that I owned it around that time in my life. And to meet someone who was real doing it made me feel a little bit ashamed. A little bit possessive and a little bit resentful about the whole situation, and all mixed up at the same time with overawe, you know. And the whole thing sort of seemed very bewildering to me as a phenomenon, you know. It was a bewildering experience.
You know, you use the word playing with someone who was real. It makes me think that you thought of yourself as not real, not...
Well, it was a bit of a kind of phony situation when you think about it. I was English, I was white, and I was dedicated to and playing the blues, or what I thought were the blues, but it was all in an unreal situation, and all derived from records that I bought or listening to the radio, and quite contrived, really. And I deliberately was trying to live what I assumed would be a blues man's lifestyle, you know, bumming around with a guitar on my shoulder. And to meet the real thing, who was... And see, Sonny Boy blew a lot of the myth away by being incredibly interested in money and women. And, you know, I had set myself up to think that, you know, a blues man was far, far above these kind of earthly pursuits. You know, I thought that it was much, you know, a blues man would be dedicated to his music and nothing else would matter. And it really wasn't like that at all. You know, it was all down to flashy suits and fast cars and... you know, the stuff that you like in life. And it really kind of shook me up.
So how did it change you?
Well, I guess I started to adopt a lot of those attitudes myself, you know, at a fairly early age. And musically, it meant that I had to get my act together, you know, because... I think that what happened with the Yardbirds was that I was one of the only ones that wanted to. The rest of the guys were... We were all a little bit intimidated by Sonny Boy, but I think the others were more than I was. You know, I was attracted as well as intimidated, and I wanted, after that, to carry on in that lifestyle, and that the others wanted really to go in a pop music direction.
My guest is Eric Clapton. He has a new album called Journeyman. Let's get back to his days with the Yardbirds. This was their first hit, For Your Love, which came out in 1965.
For your love. give you diamonds bright. There'll be days that will excite and make you dream of me at night.
You were early in your career with the group The Yardbirds and playing a mix of blues and pop, and you left the group after the band really started to get a big hit, which was For Your Love. And
yeah.
My understanding is that you left because you thought that the song was too pop and that the group was getting more commercial and going away from its blues emphasis. I wonder what you think listening back to that record now. I mean, I think it's a really good record, whether it's whether it's blues or not.
Yeah, I think it's a good record. If I hadn't been part of the band, I thought I probably would have liked it then too, but it seemed to me a huge threat at the time. And
I thought because it was taking you away from what you wanted to do?
Well, a very big disappointment, you know, because it was kind of like going out with a girl and then finding out that, you know, that she likes, I don't know, you know, Sly Stallone when you like Robert De Niro. Do you know what I mean? It's got, all your tastes suddenly start to diverge, and it was heartbreaking. It was really actually very heartbreaking, and one of the first real big disappointments in my life, because to start out with, the band was very unified in our likes and dislikes, and then I noticed that they became more kind of interested in what the, you know, Freddie and the Dreamers were wearing on stage and things like this. So, I don't know, it just really floored me, and for a while after I left that band, I really considered packing it all in because I didn't think anyone else, you know, cared about it the way I did.
What did you do when you left the band?
I went and stayed with a friend of mine in Oxford. He's a friend of mine who was a pianist first and then became a woodcarver. And he had left the band and he was carving a Tang horse as a method of sort of his way of retaliating against the rest of the band. And we sat up in Oxford and just drank wine and ate pigeon pie for about 3 or 4 months. And then John Mayall got in touch with me and asked me if I'd join his band.
Well, you joined John Mayall with the Blues Breakers, and the emphasis there really was on authenticity and on playing as closely to, you know, the blues records that inspired you as you could get. Was that a satisfying experience?
Yes, it was. I really enjoyed working with John, and I now kind of regret that I left the band so early because we'd only made one record, really, which later on seemed to become a classic, and I think it's a classic record. It would have been nice to have furthered it a bit more, and I know he'll agree with me with that, but I guess I was young and impetuous, and I wanted to go my own way. You know, I found my feet so fast with John's band that it seemed like the world was my oyster, you know.
Let's listen to one of the Blues Breakers records. My guest Eric Clapton sings and plays guitar on this one. This is the Robert Johnson song, Ramblin' on My Mind.
I'm going down to the station, catch that old fast milk train to see. I'm going down to the station, catch that old fast milk train to see. And the sun got the blue about me.
After the Blues Breakers with John Mayall, you formed Cream with Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker, and you've said that you liked Jack Bruce's irreverence, that you liked him for not trying to be authentic, bluesman.
Yeah, he came in from another area altogether, and he was one of the first musicians that was, and Ginger too, but Jack, in a much more easily identifiable way, was was a rebel, musical rebel. You know, he came from a jazz background, and it was one of the he was like one of the first fusion players I'd ever met who was willing to cross jazz into blues and rock and roll all at the same time. He didn't see that there was a musical boundary, and he was a very intellectual, one of the first musical intellectuals that I met. He was deeply into classical music and modern classical music at that, and I was for quite a while under Jack's spell, because he seemed to me to have, you know, the most unique and avant-garde attitude towards music that I'd ever met.
What did Cream bring out in your playing that you hadn't expressed before?
Freedom, I think. I during the time that I was with Cream, I was constantly being urged by Jack and Ginger to kind of throw off all of my inhibitions that I'd spent years honing with the Blues Breakers, for instance, and my blues rule book was supposed to be going out the window, and it often did. You know, when we played live more than any other time, we would simply just improvise, and it would be very hard for me, more than anyone else, to really get rid of my idea of frameworks and structures. You know, I was really the last one to be able to let go of the things that I'd been using to hold me down up until then.
My guest has been Eric Clapton. I'm Terry Gross, and on the next Fresh Air, part two of our interview, in which Clapton tells about his years with Cream and Blind Faith and talks about the ups and downs of his solo career.